A bank is robbed. There are no witnesses. Its president is missing without a trace. When a body surfaced, the criminal investigation grew deadly serious. Federal agents descended upon a small town that found itself gripped by fear.
The small community of Nome, Missouri discovered their bank was robbed. They were shocked. When the bank president turned up missing, they were outraged. But things aren't always as they first appear. And when clues began to surface, the facts were more terrible than anyone could have guessed. I'm Jim Kallstrom, former head of the FBI's New York office. For federal agents, the Nome bank robbery became an intricate case in modern forensics and dogged determination.
The Cowskin Bridge over Grand Lake, Oklahoma, just after 3 a.m. The lake is popular for fishing and boating. But on this night, it would be the scene of something far more sinister. A gruesome crime, meticulously planned and executed. A cold-blooded murder that would shatter the tranquility of the nearby town of Nome, Missouri.
No! No! No!
Tucked away in the southwest corner of Missouri and home to about 1,200 residents, Nome is a community proud of its small-town charms and low crime rate. On the morning of October 6, 1989, Pauline Coonrod headed off to work at the State Bank of Nome. The cashier's first task upon arriving was to unlock the front doors. But Coonrod found the doors already open. She thought perhaps the bank president, Dan Short, had arrived early. But as she walked through the building, she saw no one. Within moments, Coonrod realized the vault had been robbed. Nome police and the McDonald County, Missouri sheriff responded to Coonrod's 911 call. The FBI was also called in since the bank was insured by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. An agent was sent to investigate from the nearby Joplin, Missouri office. The entire scene was meticulously photographed and dusted for prints. The agent noticed that the security camera had been spray-painted and shot out. Spent casings found below the camera indicated that the robbers used a .45-caliber handgun. Investigators discovered that the thieves had made off with over $71,000, including 320 pounds of quarters, dimes, and nickels. Strangely, more than $100,000 in bills was left behind in an unlocked drawer. Bank President Dan Short was one of four bank employees with access to the vault and its time lock. Yet he was the only one of the four who hadn't arrived that morning. Questioning him became essential to the investigation. Bank Vice President Mark Allman told investigators that Short intended to work late the night before.
the time lock on the vault hadn't been set the night that the robbery occurred. Dan had came in was in the habit of working later in the evenings at different times during the week, but that particular night he'd put it on standby so that he could come back at a later time and open the vault manually.
Agents wondered if Dan Short had in fact returned to the bank that evening. The sheriff drove to Short's house in Arkansas near the Missouri border. But no one was home and his red pickup truck was gone. Short's absence alarmed investigators. They couldn't help but wonder what role the banker played in the robbery. Within hours, word of the crime spread throughout the scandalized community.
Knoll's a small town. Main industries, poultry processing plants, some small shops, local merchants, quiet town, tourism in the summertime with the rivers, that sort of thing. But basically just your average small town.
Crimes like this did not happen here. Reports of the heist and the missing bank president filled Knoll news broadcasts. Investigators received many calls from the community offering help. One call from an employee at Sibley Manufacturing just outside of town gave investigators their first break.
Hey, listen, come in this morning. I see this truck.
He reported a red pickup truck abandoned in the factory parking lot. The truck was registered to Dan Short. Investigators found coin wrappers strewn across the truck bed. The truck was dusted for fingerprints, but only Short's were identified. The discovery of the truck gave case agent and 19-year FBI veteran Liddell Farley a couple of scenarios to pursue.
At the end of the first day, we weren't sure if we were dealing with an abducted banker or whether the banker, Mr. Short, had absconded with the money. Stops were being placed with his credit card. Airports were being canvassed. Rental car agencies were being checked to see if he perhaps had leased a car. But primarily we're looking for his body, either alive or dead, in the immediate area of Knoll.
With Short still missing, investigators secured a search warrant for the bank president's house, hoping to find something that would lead to his whereabouts.
Stay place. Anybody home? Mr. Short.
Inside, all was quiet.
Trooper, look here a minute.
In the kitchen, they discovered an overturned trash can, suggesting perhaps a struggle. They searched every room.
Mike, come here a minute.
By the bed, they found Short's glasses on the nightstand. He never went anywhere without them.
Let's get some light on in here. All right. I think
that's just... It appeared that the banker had left in a hurry.
I'd say he...
Still, it was impossible to determine from the search whether he had fled or was abducted. With no sign of Short, agents canvassed his neighborhood hoping for a lead. One neighbor, Carol Dryden, recalled seeing several vehicles pulling into Short's driveway the night of the robbery. Assistant U.S. Attorney Mike Jones was involved early in the investigation. According to Jones, Dryden's statement was critical.
Around 2 o'clock in the morning, which really gave us the first time frame, she saw lights going into Dan Short's property, headlights, and then about 15 or 20 minutes later, going out of Dan Short's driveway.
But the neighbor's statement didn't put the FBI any closer to finding Short. McDonald County Sheriff Don Schlesman was a lead investigator in the case and coordinated the massive search for the banker in the area surrounding Knoll.
We set up a command post on the west side of Knoll. The groups were split up, giving roads to walk down. Highway Patrol had their helicopter down. We had airplanes. Just mainly did a search from the air and the ground.
Beginning from the location where Short's truck was found, search teams proceeded outwards in concentric circles, hoping to find a trace of Short in the immediate vicinity. 5 days after the crime, there was still no trace of the bank president. As the hunt expanded, Farley and 22 agents from the Kansas City office formed a task force with local law enforcement. To house the large number of personnel, the FBI set up headquarters at the local armory. While they unpacked, leads came pouring in from concerned residents. One tip came from local truck driver Buddy Mills. Having heard about the heist, Mills told an agent about what he saw on a road in Knoll the morning of the robbery. Returning home from work at about 3 a.m., he encountered three vehicles leaving town. One truck matched the description of Short's red pickup. It headed off with a two-tone van. The other dark-colored truck followed Mills for a while until it turned down a road toward neighboring Arkansas. This information jibed with Carol Dryden's recollection of the traffic outside of Short's house at 2 a.m. Mills' account reinforced the time frame for the crime. Farley met with the bank president's ex-wife, Joyce, who had been married to Short for 25 years. Although they had recently separated, Joyce stressed he was a loving father to their two children. Having worked closely with him at the bank for several years, she never witnessed any impropriety. Yet Short was the FBI's only suspect right now, and after several days of searching, he was still missing. On October 11th, a couple fishing in Grand Lake, just over the state line in Oklahoma, hunted for a good spot to drop a line. They motored to a favorite shady spot. Hoping to hook some bass, they sighted what looked like a clump of seaweed floating on the water. Moving closer, they made a gruesome discovery. Just under the surface, they saw the head and arms of a submerged body. 5 days after the robbery of the State Bank of Knoll, Missouri, a dead body surfaced. Two employees of the marina towed it to a dock. The body was badly decomposed, but the coroner determined that the man had been dead for 5 days. Immediately after death, bacteria begin to break down the soft tissues of the organs, releasing gaseous compounds.
So we got a white male?
After a few days, the gas fills the corpse and can lift the submerged body to the surface. Sheriff Don Schlesman recalled the bloated remains lifted additional weight from the bottom of the lake.
He had the chain tied to him in a concrete block and part of a chair. And it was a pretty gruesome sight, really.
A corpse will float until the skin tears, releasing the gases. Then the body will sink back to the bottom. If the boaters hadn't seen the body that day, it may have never been found. The time of death was later determined to be consistent with the time frame of Dan Short's disappearance. The sheriff found a wallet in the victim's back pocket. Inside was a driver's license confirming the identity as Dan Short. The sheriff contacted the FBI. The search for 51-year-old Dan Short was over, and a homicide investigation had begun.
With his surfacing, which was almost in defiance of the people who had murdered him, it gave us the knowledge of what had happened, and it gave us the focus that we needed in the investigation to direct resources thereafter.
Farley and his partner Larry Nolan rushed to the lake to conduct their own review of the body. Special Agent Nolan's first task was to preserve the evidence.
Collectively, the decision was made to release Mr. Short from the chair, at which time I released him and preserved the concrete block and the chain hoist, the chair, and also the duct tape.
Okay, guys, that's undone.
With Short's corpse freed from his death trap, the coroner removed the body. The medical examiner determined the probable cause of death was drowning. The chair with the block, chain hoist, and duct tape were examined and photographed by investigators before being sent to the FBI lab in Washington, D.C. The task force set up a hotline and published pictures of the chair to alert the public, hoping someone would come forward with information.
It was clear from examining the chair and the apparatus, so to speak, that was attached to it, and the location of Mr. Short's body, that he had died a horrible death. All indications are that he was conscious when he was dropped from the bridge some 30 feet to the water.
The hotline was inundated with calls, helping build a file of more than 80 suspects. According to Sheriff Don Schlesman, one promising tip came from an anonymous caller who urged investigators to question two brothers, Joe and Shannon Agofsky.
The Joplin Police Department dispatch received an anonymous call from someone that said the Agofskys had a lot of change in their possession, and a lot of change was what was taken from the bank.
The FBI tracked down 23-year-old Joe Agofsky at a junkyard just south of Noel. The manager pointed agents to where Joe worked on his car.
He's working right out there in that yard right there.
Oh, that's him right there in the black vest?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
How are you doing? Are you Joe Agofsky?
Yes, sir.
Joe said that on the night of the robbery, he had been at his girlfriend's house, more than 40 miles from Noel.
Is she available, and does she live locally here?
Yes, sir.
Okay, very good.
We're also interested in 45 handguns. Do you have them?
He was cooperative and told them he had two 45 caliber handguns.
Could we see it?
The same caliber as the weapon used to shoot out the security camera. They inquired if they could test fire the guns. Joe agreed and told investigators the weapons were stored at his home. His 18-year-old brother Shannon would be there to meet them.
And your brothers, is this?
When the agents arrived, Shannon Agofsky showed them where the guns were kept. Shannon told investigators that on the night of the murder, he was at his mother's house, where he was still living at the time of the crime.
All right. It's going to be all right if we take these downtown?
After firing both guns, agents sent the shell casings to the FBI lab. Examiners there would later determine that they did not match those found at the bank. To lead Agent Farley, it was a dead end.
Both expressed their willingness to help the investigation if they could. Both had alibis for the evening of the crime. Given these factors, our attention was directed elsewhere with other suspects, as both the Agofsky brothers appeared to be not involved in this crime.
Back at Grand Lake in Oklahoma, where Short's body had been recovered 2 days earlier, resident Rowdy Foreman was out fishing with his son and daughter when he made a curious discovery along the shore.
We came across a wooden dowel, a brace, if you want to call it that, and it was just out of place.
Alongside the chair part, Foreman also found a piece of duct tape. Having seen pictures in the newspaper, he believed it may have been from the chair found with Short's body. He sent his son to fetch plastic bags from his house in order to preserve his find. Sheriff Don Schlesman and a partner drove to Oklahoma to question Foreman about the discovery.
And they asked me, do you have a piece of evidence? I told them, I said, I don't know if it's evidence. I said, I found a piece of duct tape. And his first comment was, oh my God, isn't that pretty? And they were looking at the fingerprint, just clear as day, it was a print there.
The fingerprint appeared to be made from car grease, impervious to the lake water. But investigators still had to prove the tape was used in the crime.
Although the tape contained fingerprints, that piece of evidence was not relevant unless it could be proven to be part of the chair or the apparatus in which Mr. Short was drowned.
To prove that, FBI examiners would have to match the glue and strands from the torn piece of tape with the tape found on the chair. But that would take weeks. Until then, the FBI and local investigators still had no prime suspects for the crime. A week after the robbery of the State Bank of Knoll, Missouri, and the brutal murder of its president, Dan Short, the FBI had recovered Short's body, the murder device, and a possible fingerprint from a nearby lake. Investigators fielded calls from residents who were willing to help, but also afraid to do so.
Due to the manner in which Mr. Short was killed, although the local citizens were very concerned and wanted to be helpful, some were reluctant to do so out of fear. Therefore, some of the witnesses did not come forth. They did so sometimes out of the insistence of a friend or an associate.
Farley received one such call from a man who claimed his friend might have information about the chain hoist wrapped around the chair that drowned Dan Short. The friend's name was Wayne Boutain. Boutain owned a chain hoist which had recently been stolen. Though he notified the police, the hoist was never recovered. He suspected the Agofskis of stealing it. Farley showed Boutain the photos of the hoist investigators had retrieved from the lake. Boutain identified it as his own. He recognized damage on the pulley. He'd last seen the apparatus at Sheila Agofsky's house where he had once lived. Boutain agreed to take a polygraph test and passed it.
Another important development in the case was the determination that the chain hoist, which was duct taped to the chair, was property of Wayne Boutain, who had left it at the residence of Sheila Agofsky a few days before the murder of Mr. Short.
On the strength of Boutain's statement, Farley decided to question the Agofskys again. Driving up to their mother's house, he noticed an old van in the front yard. It closely matched the description of one of the vehicles Buddy Mills saw the night of the bank heist.
Can I help you with anything?
Yes, ma'am.
Farley questioned Sheila about the missing chain hoist, but she claimed to have no memory of it. She also corroborated Shannon's alibi, saying he was at her house the night of the murder.
I don't know anything about it. I have no idea.
Okay.
I can't help you with anything.
I appreciate your time. We'll be back in touch.
Farley left, with suspicions that she knew more than she was telling. He asked the brothers to give their fingerprints, hoping to match the one found on the duct tape. Joe Agofsky complied. When asked about the hoist, he told Farley he remembered seeing it at his mother's house. Yet he didn't know what became of it. A few days later, Farley returned to Sheila Ogofsky's.
I'm Special Agent Farley.
There he found Shannon with a friend by the name of Gant Sanders. Having secured Joe's fingerprints, Farley tried to convince Shannon to give his as well.
A set of his fingerprints. It'd make things a lot easier. Possibly get you out of some trouble.
Joe Ogofsky was very cooperative and produced his fingerprints upon request without hesitation, while Shannon was evasive and hesitant to.
Gant Sanders watched cautiously. Shannon echoed his mother's story, proclaiming he had no knowledge of the chain hoist.
I'll be seeing you guys later.
He eventually promised Farley he'd come down to the police station to give his prints, but he never showed. Although Farley had initially dismissed the Ogofskys as suspects, he took note that Shannon and Joe's memories of the chain hoist were conflicting. Now, he decided to take a closer look into their background. Researching the family's financial records, Farley discovered that 9 years earlier, they had received money from an insurance settlement after their father died in a plane crash. Popular opinion was that their money was still plentiful, making them unlikely candidates for bank robbers. But Farley learned that wasn't so.
While they had all received a considerable sum of money, as of that time, Joe had spent his. Their mother had spent a large portion of hers, and Shannon Ogofsky had a considerable amount of money still in a fund, but it was not available to him at that time until he was 21.
Agents found that both brothers had recently purchased cars with cash, yet neither had jobs. Investigators also determined that 18-year-old Shannon had spent more than $5,000 since the heist. Although the Ogofsky brothers' spending looked suspicious, Farley still had no solid evidence linking them to the bank robbery and murder. Revisiting crime reports and witness statements, he made a new connection. Truck driver Buddy Mills said he had seen three vehicles leaving Noel on the night of the robbery. That meant there was a possible third suspect out there. If two of the vehicles were driven by the Ogofsky brothers, then perhaps the other was driven by one of their friends. Farley recalled the young man he met briefly on the Ogofsky's porch the day he questioned Shannon, Gant Sanders. Sanders had recently become Shannon's roommate. Farley tracked him down at a junkyard.
The closest associate that we could identify of both Shannon and Joe Ogofsky was Gant Sanders. It was learned that Gant had been good friends with both Joe and Shannon, both prior to and after the robbery and murder.
But Sanders said he knew nothing about the robbery and murder, although he offered no alibi for the night in question. Farley decided to question Shannon again, this time with a polygraph machine.
A couple of things about the test is nothing will be painful.
The test was administered in a motel room by a technician from the Missouri capital of Springfield. A polygraph is used by investigators as a tool to rule out possible suspects. The machine monitors the subject's reactions to stress in three ways. Tubes fastened around the chest monitor the slightest change in respiration. Low-voltage electrodes placed on the finger detect moisture on the skin.
All right, relax your arms.
And a cuff on the arm measures changes in blood pressure. The examination is based on the body's fight or flight principle.
I'll need you to sit perfectly still.
When the brain perceives a physical or psychological threat, the body responds by increasing blood pressure, heart rate, and respiration. Shannon Ogofsky was asked about Dan Short, the robbery, and the murder.
Did you take a chain hoist from Wayne Butane's?
No.
Did you kill Dan Short?
No.
Based on his physiological responses, the examiner determined that the younger Rogowski brother was deceptive about his knowledge of the crime. It was clear to Farley that Shannon was somehow involved.
You do.
But he'd need more convincing evidence to bring charges.
Figure out what's best for yourself.
In December 1989, the Rogowskis were subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury to answer questions under oath. Each family member gave testimony separately. Shannon, Joe, and Sheila each disavowed any knowledge of the bank robbery and the murder of Dan Short. After questioning, Shannon was once again asked to supply his fingerprints voluntarily.
Can you tell me where these are?
Again, he agreed and set an appointment. In Washington, D.C., FBI analysts continued to examine the items sent to them by the agents in Knoll, trying to match the chair part and tape retrieved by Foreman to the chair and tape that had been bound to Dan Short. An examiner confirmed that the wood found by Rowdy Foreman was part of the same chair that Dan Short was taped to. The piece of tape with the fingerprint on it was the most promising piece of evidence. But did it match the tape used on the chair and body? It did. Examiners were conclusively able to link these portions of tape by matching the torn ends, the fibers, and the glue. The tape found by Foreman had two complete prints on it. They compared the prints to Joe Agofsky's, but they did not match. Farley recalled this finding was not all bad news.
The fingerprint examiner notified me that the prints on the tape were similar to that of Joe Agofsky, but not identical. And he advised me that the fingerprints of siblings were often similar in pattern. Therefore, getting the fingerprints of Shannon Agofsky was imperative.
Although he told the grand jury he would provide his fingerprints, Shannon never did. But this time, Farley would force Shannon to comply by serving him with a subpoena. Grudgingly, Shannon Agofsky gave his prints to the FBI almost 5 months after the heist and murder. Since comparing his prints to those found on the tape would take several weeks, Shannon was free to go. But Agent Farley did not remain idle. He knew that Gant Sanders was close to both brothers and probably knew more about the crime than he had said. So he decided to confront him. He told Sanders that if he was innocent and had knowledge of the crime, he should cooperate with the investigation. But if Sanders was knowingly protecting the Agofskis and they were convicted of the robbery and murder, Sanders would be jailed for aiding and abetting. Worse, without a solid alibi, he was still under suspicion of the crime. But Sanders revealed nothing. He remained faithful to the brothers. Farley thought that perhaps Sanders was hiding his guilt with his silence. Agent Farley pursued two brothers, Joe and Shannon Agofsky, as the prime suspects in the bank heist and murder. Joe's fingerprints had been compared to the two found on the duct tape from the murder device. His did not match. As investigators waited for results on a comparison with Shannon's, additional partial prints were discovered on the tape. Now the FBI needed new prints from Shannon, a 360-degree view to match the partial prints on the duct tape. But Shannon was nowhere to be found. Farley hoped that he could get to Shannon through one of the Agofsky brothers' friends, Gant Sanders. The agent also suspected Sanders could be the unidentified accomplice. But cooperating with the FBI would mean betraying his longtime friends. Finally, in June of 1990, hoping to clear his name, he contacted Farley, wanting to talk. Investigators told Sanders they thought that he had helped commit the bank robbery and murder in Knoll with the Agofsky brothers. But Sanders claimed he had nothing to do with the crime. However, he did admit to his involvement in another more recent incident. On one particular evening in late December 1989, Shannon and Joe Agofsky broke into a house in Missouri and stole several rifles. The brothers rendezvoused with Sanders later that evening, setting the second part of their plan into action. The next day, Sanders and Shannon drove across the state line into Arkansas and sold the guns. It was a federal violation. Sanders recalled another time when the brothers tried to convince him to participate in another, more violent crime just months after Dan Short's murder. Sheriff Don Schlesman recalled how the Agofskys tried to recruit Sanders.
And they told him, we're not doing any more Mickey Mouse stuff. We're going to go hit a place, and there's probably going to be some shooting because they got armed guards. And if you don't really want to kill somebody, you'd probably better let us know so we can take you back home. And so Gant told him he didn't really think he wanted to be involved in something like that, so they turned around and did take him home.
By cooperating with the FBI, Sanders made a deal for his role in the illegal sale of the firearms and was put on probation. He was also finally dismissed as a third suspect in the bank robbery, passing a lie detector test three times. With the help of Sanders' statement, Farley issued a federal warrant for Shannon Agofsky. He was indicted for transporting and selling firearms across state lines. Since Joe had not been involved in the sale, he was not charged. Authorities tracked down Shannon in a small town in Arkansas several months later. When apprehended, police searched his vehicle and found several bags of nickels in his trunk. Shannon was turned over to authorities in Missouri and booked in the Springfield Federal Courthouse.
Look at me.
While being processed, Farley acquired the set of Shannon's fingerprints examiners had been waiting for. The FBI lab needed a front and back view of his prints, hoping to match two partial prints found on the duct tape used in the murder of Dan Short. But his older brother, Joe, was still free, and Farley had little evidence to tie him to the crimes. Investigators knew the brothers remained in contact while Shannon was behind bars. Since all prison conversations were recorded, agents got a glimpse into the Agofsky's family relationship. Shannon made a number of calls to his mother and Joe. According to Assistant U.S. Attorney Mike Jones, one call was particularly incriminating.
Shannon was asking Joe if we would be able to make a case against him, and Joe indicated that we would not be able to put him at the scene.
Farley knew the brothers were worried, but the call was not enough to arrest Joe. Then, just days later, he finally received the results from the lab.
Those fingerprints turn out to be the fingerprints of Shannon Agofsky. The tape was determined to have come from the chair in which Mr. Short was bound to. Therefore, that piece of tape became a most important piece of evidence in this case.
Mike Jones now had a strong case against Shannon.
We knew we were going to prosecute Shannon once we got those first two fingerprints, and then the main focus was on Joe, trying to get a case built against Joe.
How's it going?
Finding evidence against Joe was a thorny task. Nothing directly linked him to the crime. Once again, Farley combed through financial records to see how much Joe had spent.
We attempted to determine all his cash transactions and did determine that he had spent some $19,000 in cash during the 16 months following the robbery. During that time, he was unemployed and had no logical explanation for having that much cash.
Scrutinizing Joe's phone records, Farley made another important find.
Right at.
Joe had made several long-distance calls to his girlfriend at her home during the very days leading up to and after the robbery.
Yeah.
The calls destroyed his alibi. Joe had stated that he was staying with her the entire time.
Not too smart.
They called Sanders in for additional questioning, hoping he could shed more light on Joe's involvement. Sanders told the agents about a conversation he had with both Agofsky brothers. That incident took place in Sammy Skaggs' junkyard.
The three of them were working on one of the cars, and Sammy Skaggs announced that the banker from Joplin was here to pick up his car. And that apparently generated a comment from, I believe it was Joe, that what the three of them ought to do was to follow a banker, follow him home, grab him, kidnap him, and force him to take him to the bank and open the vault.
At the time, Sanders agreed that it might be an easy way to get rich. The plan sounded eerily like what could have happened to Dan Short. It was now clear to the FBI that the brothers had the knowledge, motive, and opportunity to pull off the homicide and heist. Based on accumulating evidence, Joe Agofsky was arrested more than 2 years after the horrifying crime. Both brothers were indicted on three federal counts relating to the bank robbery and murder. But would the evidence be strong enough to convict the two brothers? The investigators were betting on it. Almost 3 years after a bank heist and brutal murder, FBI agent Liddell Farley handed prosecutors all the evidence the task force had amassed. Reviewing their files, the agents described the Agofsky's plans and actions to Assistant U.S. Attorney Mike Jones and his associates. They were determined to prove beyond any doubt that the brothers had committed the crime. The FBI had learned that Joe Agofsky, needing information about the state bank's floor plan, had opened a safe deposit box a few weeks before the crime. Bank Vice President Mark Allman told investigators that Joe was particularly interested in Dan Short as well. He made a point of asking who Short was and where he lived.
He's our president. Would you like to meet him?
Oh, no, thanks. I was just asking who he was.
Returning home, Joe drew floor plans to the bank and plotted the crime with Shannon. They decided to do the job before the sun rose, so there would be no witnesses.
We're gonna go through the front door. When we get through there, I want you guys to knock the cameras out. Now, he has that
to get into the vault, they needed someone who had the keys and knew the combination.
Make sure you get them keys.
For that, they would abduct Dan Short, the bank president, and force him to open the vault. Afterwards, they needed to make sure he'd never talk.
Give that combination up.
They thought it would be easy money. Life would be good with their new fortunes.
Let's get these guns clean.
In the early hours of October 6th, Joe and Shannon Agofsky put their plan into motion. Acting as a lookout for them was an unidentified accomplice who drove the blue Chevy pickup. It was the same vehicle neighbor Carol Dryden recalled seeing around Short's house a week before the kidnapping. The brothers loaded their mother's brown and tan van with the equipment they would need to commit the crime. At around 2 a.m., they arrived at Dan Short's house, a brief trip across the Arkansas border. Eventually, he awoke from a deep sleep. The intruders would be the last people he ever saw.
Get out of here.
Short tried to flee. But he had no chance against the brothers and their accomplice. They threatened to kill him unless he turned over his keys to the bank. Silencing him, the intruders dragged Short outside. The terror continued as Short was stuffed into the front seat of the van. Each criminal drove one of the vehicles, including Short's red pickup, as they sped off for the bank. Agent Farley and the prosecutors continued piecing together the events of October 6th. The Agofskis and their accomplice pulled up to the bank, only a brief drive from Short's house. With their captive in tow, the robbers quickly opened the bank's front door and ran in. No alarm sounded because Short had neglected to set them, and no one would ever be able to see what was about to happen.
Let's go to that desk.
Ripping the duct tape off his mouth, they pulled Short over to his desk and retrieved the keys to the safe. Then they forced him to provide the vault's combination.
Hurry up! 22 right.
Let's open.
Once inside, they grabbed all that was in reach.
Get him out! Get out!
And dashed away.
Go! I'll blow your head off. Move it!
They dumped the loot in the truck. Afraid for his life, Short complied with their every demand. But the assailant's pistol whipped him and knocked him out. On the way out of Noah, Buddy Mills crossed paths with the brothers. After he passed the intersection, the three vehicles sped off, the first two heading toward Grand Lake. Reaching Grand Lake, some 22 miles from Noah, the two remaining vehicles stopped along the high point of the Cowskin Bridge. Here, Shannon and the unknown accomplice prepared to kill Short by drowning him. In his haste, Shannon took off his gloves to secure a portion of the tape.
Shut up!
And unknowingly left greasy fingerprints behind. Then the two attached the stolen chain hoist.
I'll do anything. Anything you want.
When they finished, they lifted Short above the lake.
Oh, no!
And plunged him into the black water below. At the first trial in September 1992, the evidence was strong enough to persuade a jury to convict Shannon and Joe Agofsky of three federal crimes relating to the robbery, abduction, and use of firearms during the illegal acts. In the state trial, only Shannon was found guilty of murder. Though the unidentified accomplice was never found, it was determined that the Agofsky brothers were the masterminds and principal perpetrators of the crime. No charges were brought against their mother, Sheila.
Without doubt, this was the most difficult investigation I've been involved in as an FBI agent. Some 29 years of investigating various crimes, this was an unusually heinous crime.
Today, Joe and Shannon Agofsky are serving life sentences with no chance of parole. For his cooperation, Gant Sanders served the remainder of his firearms charge on probation. Noel has returned to normal. A violent chapter in its history now closed. Yet because of the crimes of these blood brothers, it will never be the same quiet, innocent place it once was. A pair of serial killers roamed the Midwest, preying on adults and children alike. Always a step behind, agents had no choice but to follow the trail of bodies. As the crime spree raged out of control, pressure mounted to stop these killers.
Swept through six states like a plague, thrill killers acting without rhyme or reason. They targeted adults and young girls, kidnapping, murdering, then moving on to kill again. And in their rampage, they left plenty of clues. But moving targets are the hardest to hit. I'm Jim Kallstrom, former head of the FBI's New York office. The hunt was on for these killers with a knack for eluding authorities. We hoped a nationwide dragnet would bring them to justice.
In Kenosha, Wisconsin, a community close to the Illinois border, single mother Juanita Wheat arrived home with her 9-year-old daughter, Vernita, and their new friend, Robert Knight. It was getting late on the evening of May 29th, 1984, when they returned from a day of fun at a local carnival. Robert told Juanita that he had a belated Mother's Day present for her at his place just a few blocks away. He asked if Vernita could help him carry it back. He promised it would only take an hour. Reluctant at first, Juanita gave in to her daughter's excited pleas.
All right.
Be good, bye, baby.
All right, we'll be right back.
Take care,
puppy. I will.
As it approached midnight, Robert and Vernita had not yet returned. Vernita was anxious about leaving her apartment to look for her daughter. If Vernita arrived to an empty home, the young girl might panic. But the worry became too great. Vernita decided to go and find her daughter. She went to the address Robert had given her. When she arrived, her panic melted into horror. The building that Robert Knight claimed was his home was abandoned. Not knowing where else to turn, Juanita went to her friend Ellen Reeves for help. Concerned for the safety of her friend's daughter, Ellen insisted it was time to contact the police. Juanita told the officer that her happy, outgoing daughter would not have run away. The officer's focus turned to Robert Knight. Juanita said she had met Robert a month earlier. He introduced himself while riding through the neighborhood on his bike. They had become friendly, and Robert had become fond of young Vernita. The police didn't have a Robert Knight on record. The officer asked Juanita to check mugshots for anyone who might look like him. Juanita scanned two books of photos. Finally, she pointed to a picture of a man she was sure was Robert Knight. Officers determined that the person Juanita had identified as Robert Knight was really named Alton Coleman. Investigators called the FBI.
Special Agent Berdina Passanelli of the FBI's Kenosha, Wisconsin office was assigned the investigation.
But the FBI always gets involved when children of tender years disappear under unusual circumstances, and this was clearly one of those.
Investigators wasted no time in obtaining a search warrant for Coleman's last known address, his grandmother's house in Waukegan, Illinois, just a few miles across the state line from where the Weeks lived. A young woman answered the door. When questioned by the detective, she identified herself as Deborah Brown, Coleman's girlfriend. At first, Brown was reluctant to answer any questions about Coleman or his whereabouts. She said she had been living at the residence for a year, providing home care for Coleman's nearly blind grandmother. The investigators persisted. They finally convinced Deborah to cooperate. She told them that Coleman had been gone all night, but came home alone at about 8 o'clock in the morning. He had come by to change into a suit for a court appearance later that morning. Coleman had been charged with raping a 14-year-old girl at knife point. Brown also admitted that Coleman had told her he had done something really bad the night before, but he did not explain what. Investigators waited at the house for Coleman's return while other officers canvassed the area.
Okay, do you know if he, did he drive?
He was nowhere to be found. The FBI joined forces with local investigators. Detectives from Kenosha and nearby Waukegan, Illinois, already knew Coleman's reputation. He was a violent criminal with a disturbing past.
As I learned about Coleman, I realized he was extremely dangerous because the Waukegan Police Department had an extensive arrest record on him. He had been arrested almost 10 years previously for the rape of a 40-year-old woman, and he had a number of other arrests, mostly for assault, for molestation, rape of a child. And as you looked at these cases and you listened to the detectives who were familiar with him, you saw a picture of an increasingly violent person.
The task force enlisted every available officer and agent to help in the search for Coleman and Vernita.
Well, our strategy that night was to find Alton Coleman. We sat down then at the police department and assembled everything we knew. We came up with information that he a lot of times rode the train, he took taxis because he didn't have a car. What happened then is we split up into teams and went out and started interviewing people.
On the streets, investigators talked with drivers at various taxi stands. Everyone was familiar with Alton Coleman. The cabbies agreed that if they saw him, they would notify the police. The task force offered a $5,000 reward for information leading to Coleman's arrest. The promise of a reward caught people's attention, but didn't draw out any useful leads as quickly as the investigators hoped. Investigators feared that time may be running out for Vernita Wheat. On May 31st, 2 days into the investigation, a cab driver in Waukegan, who knew Coleman from the neighborhood, called in to report he was picking Coleman up. Squad car conducting surveillance in the area responded. Coleman was dropped off at his sister Terry's place. He saw the approaching officer and took off.
disappeared into the neighborhood he knew so well. The investigation was only 2 days old, and their suspect was within their grasp. Investigators speculated Coleman was probably hiding out in the abandoned warehouses that ran along Lake Michigan. Hoping that Coleman might respond to his sister's voice, the detective summoned her.
Waukegan police, ma'am, please open up.
I'm Detective Hanson from Luther's, Antoine.
Though she was Coleman's own flesh and blood, she was also a mother of a young girl. The agents convinced her to help. Talking to her brother through a bullhorn, she pleaded with him to turn himself in.
Alton, you need to come on out and give yourself up.
Meanwhile, officers and agents fanned out and searched the area. But even in such a confined space, finding Coleman would not be easy. Lieutenant Mark Hansen of the Waukegan Police Department was a lead investigator for the task force.
This area has a lot of abandoned buildings, a lot of abandoned apartment complexes. It's heavily brushed. It was at nighttime. Easy to escape in there and not be seen again. This was 1984. You know, we didn't have helicopters with searchlights. We didn't have infrared. You know, we didn't have the resources to fully encircle an area of that size.
The search continued through the night. But after 8 hours, it seemed their suspect and their best chance of finding 9-year-old Vernita had slipped through their fingers. Desperate to generate leads, investigators saturated the local media with details surrounding the abduction. TV and newspapers ran photographs of Vernita Wheat, asking anyone with any information to contact the task force. The news spread quickly. Investigators were flooded with sightings of Coleman from the public. Most were dead ends. But one cab driver who saw Vernita's picture on the news contacted the task force. He remembered picking up Coleman and the little girl on the night of her disappearance. He had assumed they were father and daughter. The cab driver dropped them off around midnight near a scrapyard in the industrial section of Waukegan. Investigators approached the night manager at the scrapyard.
Evening.
Hi.
Sir, I'm Detective Hanson, Waukegan Police. Here's my card. This is Agent Showers.
He told them that he had, in fact, seen a man with a young girl on the night in question. He recalled that close to midnight, the two had walked hand in hand through the side gate. He couldn't really see the man's face, but he did notice that the man had an unusual rolling gait to his walk, a feature that acquaintances of Coleman had described. The night manager identified the little girl as Vernita Wheat. The sighting was enough to allow the FBI to issue a federal warrant for Alton Coleman. He had taken Vernita across state lines. It was also the last time anyone saw Vernita Wheat alive. The task force responded with another massive search.
We had about 150 FBI agents and detectives from both Kenosha and Waukegan. We did a methodical search where Coleman was last seen with Vernita. This included using dogs going through the junkyard, house to house and abandoned building searches, all in this downtown area, and we found nothing.
Investigators knew she was alive at midnight on the evening she disappeared. They also knew that Coleman was alone the next morning at 8 a.m. as he prepared for his court appearance. The question was, what happened to Vernita during that 8-hour gap? FBI Special Agent Jeff Showers was on the task force.
he struggled to fit the pieces together.
How far is he going to travel with this girl? The girl may not even be in Waukegan. She may be in another town. But we knew that the longer that we waited, it was getting dimmer and dimmer.
Coleman and Vernita seemed to have vanished. On the night of June 19th, 3 weeks after Vernita's disappearance, investigators received a call from a man in Waukegan who was looking through an abandoned building for scrap metal to sell. On the second floor of the wrecked apartments, he made a horrifying discovery. The body of a child lay on the bathroom floor. Alton Coleman, the FBI's prime suspect in the abduction of 9-year-old Vernita Wheat from her home in Kenosha, Wisconsin, remained at large. As the hunt for Coleman intensified, a man scouring for scrap metal in an abandoned building in Waukegan, Illinois, came across the lifeless body of a young girl. The forensic team arrived at the building. Beneath a blanket, wrapped in a man's corduroy jacket, the investigators found the young girl. Her hands, feet, and neck were bound by a television cable. She was too badly decomposed to confirm her identity. But Special Agent Jeff Showers believed they had found the body of Vernita Wheat.
The clothing matched the description that we had from the mother. She was still wearing the barrettes in her hair that matched from what her mother had described her as being last known to be wearing. She was wearing the green nylon jacket. In the pocket of the jacket were carnival tickets, and we knew from an interview of her mother that the night in question, Alton Coleman had taken Vernita Wheat to a carnival.
While the investigators suspected the body was Vernita Wheat, it was up to the forensic team to prove that the remains were hers. They also needed to find evidence that could conclusively point to the killer. Starting from the location of the body, they worked their way out in concentric circles, collecting anything that looked like it could be used as evidence. Investigators swabbed walls and door frames in an effort to find prints. Figuring whoever moved the body into the room had to come in contact with the door, they removed it from its hinges and sent it to the FBI labs in Washington, D.C. Under the lab's microscopes, FBI examiners discerned a thumbprint on the door. Comparison to samples they had on file were conclusive. The thumbprint came from Alton Coleman. Examiners also compared prints taken from the little girl's hands to those lifted from Vernita Wheat's school books that had been retrieved from her home. That comparison was also positive. The search for Vernita was over. Investigators now had enough evidence to issue another warrant for Alton Coleman. This time, it was for the murder of Vernita Wheat.
We knew then that Alton Coleman was responsible for the death of this child. And now we've got not only a kidnapper, but we also have someone who's committed murder.
While at the autopsy to determine Vernita Wheat's exact cause of death, a television news broadcast caught the attention of Agent Showers and Detective Hansen.
The first news that a little girl had been found murdered in Gary, Indiana. Agent Showers, I think, immediately thought that there could be some connection to Coleman.
The report also mentioned something that investigators found disturbing. There were two killers, and the second suspect was described as being a black female. Investigators immediately suspected Coleman's girlfriend, Deborah Brown, who had not been seen in weeks. If investigators were right, Alton Coleman and Deborah Brown had traveled 90 miles from their hometown neighborhood.
Okay, you can
They were on the move, and they were leaving bodies along their way. At the hospital in Gary, Indiana, local police officers questioned 9-year-old Mary James about the afternoon of June 16th. Mary told the officers that she and 7-year-old Janice Clay were walking to the store when they were approached by a man and a woman on bikes. The couple introduced themselves. They told the little girls that they had some clothes that the girls might like. To retrieve the clothes, Mary and Janice followed the couple into the woods. Mary was close to death when she managed to drag herself to the street. She was able to identify Coleman, but could not identify Brown from photographs sent by the FBI. However, the girl's description matched Brown exactly. Now, investigators were dealing with two killers.
We had looked at Deborah Brown up until that point in time as a witness because she had cooperated with us in Waukegan. She had told us about Alton telling her that he had done something wrong. She showed us the clothes that he had been wearing the night he had come back, when he'd been out all night and when he came back in the morning. So we had looked at her as a witness. We now knew from the investigation in Gary that she was likely assisting him.
Investigators struggled to figure out some way to predict Coleman and Brown's next move. Both murders occurred in largely black communities where the two could easily blend in. And they were quick to gain people's trust.
These were street people. They had that charm. They didn't have to do any arm twisting. It was always a very easy thing with them.
Searching for anything that might help them locate and stop the killers, investigators consulted an FBI behavioral profiler. For the profiler, the escalating pattern of violence was caused by Coleman's legal problems back in Waukegan.
He saw the fact that he had taken Vernita the night before a court appearance on the rape of a 14-year-old, and that he had abducted her, and then murdered her, as an indication that he was responding to the stress of the court appearance, and so that he would continue to murder out of anger and stress and rage.
Investigators had reason to fear that the two murders were only the beginning of a ferocious crime spree. To capture a serial killer, the profiler suggested a massive national media campaign aimed at the black communities.
So we started a publicity campaign, releasing his photograph, releasing pictures of Brown to the media, press releases, everything we could to get his picture out in the forefront. Our hope was that somebody would see him and turn him in.
But the task force was always a step behind. On July 8th, agents received information from local Ohio detectives about an elderly woman named Rose Wiggins who reported her daughter missing. Rose explained that earlier in the day she had come by to check on her daughter and found the door locked. Her young grandson, James, was too frightened to open the door. The detective convinced him they were there to help. Now he had nothing to fear. Officers immediately started to search the house for the boy's missing mother. While looking, they found 3-year-old Johnny, afraid like his older brother. Meanwhile, James told the detective about the man and woman who had been at their house.
They were in his house.
He showed the 8-year-old photos of the suspects, Coleman and Brown.
This is the lady, right?
James positively identified them as the couple who were there the night before.
You're absolutely sure.
Searching the house for the boy's mother, the police found blood smeared throughout the kitchen. It led down to the basement. Not knowing who or what awaited them, the investigators followed the grisly trail. In Ohio, police responding to a missing persons call made an alarming discovery. The young son of the missing mother had identified fugitives Coleman and Brown as having been in their home. Blood stained the walls. They proceeded cautiously, not knowing if their suspects could still be lurking in the darkened basement. The trail stopped, where the bodies of mother and daughter, Virginia and Kimberly Blake, were discovered, shoved into a crawl space beneath their home.
Coleman and Brown, we didn't know where they were, and the violence connected with the murders and the crime scenes was beginning to intensify.
The officers continued their search, still believing their suspects could be somewhere in the family's home. But they seemed to have slipped away, leaving behind unmistakable evidence, clippings of jerry-curled hair. James recounted for investigators that his mother, Virginia, had met Coleman and Brown earlier in the day. The couple stopped by the house and played with the kids. Virginia invited them to stay for dinner. It was just like any other summer evening in the neighborhood. Virginia cooked while the kids hung around and chatted with their new friends. 8-year-old James saw Coleman take a knife from the counter and slip it into his back pocket.
Soup's on, guys. Soup's on.
After enjoying dinner together, Coleman, Brown, James, and his younger brother settled into the living room to watch television. At the top of the evening news, the story of a pair of killers on the loose flashed across the screen. Coleman immediately turned off the television and shuffled the boys off to bed.
Have a good night.
While Kimberly and Virginia washed the dishes. Aware of the growing media attention, Coleman realized he and Deborah needed to change their look. He found some scissors and cut off his hair. Coleman, with Brown at his side, approached the little girl and her mother. Just upstairs, James and Johnny were asleep.
What are you doing?
They dragged the slain woman and her daughter downstairs and stuffed them into a crawl space.
The pressure was mounting. It was becoming increasingly stressful because here we were, for the fourth time, catching up with him when we found more bodies.
Coleman and Brown's M.O. was designed to catch their victims off guard.
Okay, Raymond, nothing's gonna happen.
When someone comes up to your house on a bicycle, you figure them to be local. If they're walking, you may be a little bit suspicious. But if they're riding a bike, they're from the neighborhood. Your guard is automatically down.
News of the murdered mother and daughter horrified the community. The savage nature of the killings caused the FBI to add an 11th position on their 10 most wanted fugitives list. It was a rare occurrence. The number 11 ranking was reserved for particularly vicious killers, a description fitting Coleman and Brown.
The magnitude and the importance of it that, you know, you've already got 10 that are bad, but here's one that's so bad, but we don't have room to put anybody else on. We're going to make an exception and put him on anyway, even though he's number 11.
With the national media spotlight focusing on the couple, it would be difficult for them to remain anonymous.
And in solving fugitive cases, finding people, there is nothing better than publicity. Because all you need is the one phone call from one person saying, I saw this picture and I know it's this individual.
Phone calls poured in with more frequency and speed than ever before. Any crime that matched their suspect's MO was funneled back to the task force headquarters. Hopefully, they would be able to get one step ahead of the fugitives. Investigators were sure that Coleman and Brown would tire of a life on the run and return to familiar territory. Agents contacted everyone the two associated with in Waukegan.
We would contact them and let them know that we're still looking for them. We would go out and tell them that Alton and Deborah had been involved in another murder case, hoping that that would get them a little bit more on our side.
On July 13th, local investigators responded to a frantic 911 call from a suburb of Cincinnati, Ohio. Michelle Stone told the officers what had happened that day.
They were both young.
A couple arrived at the Stone's house earlier that morning. They told Michelle's father, Jack Stone, that they were interested in buying his camper, which was for sale in the driveway. Jack's wife, Anna, joined them on the porch. As Jack and Anna chatted with them, Michelle left for work.
I won't be long. I'll see you guys later. Can we home for dinner?
Yeah.
All right.
Be careful, Mom. Bye.
I didn't really see them.
When she arrived home later that day, Michelle noticed the bikes the couple had arrived on were still in the yard. And her father's car was missing.
Mom?
Inside, she found her parents' home had been vandalized.
Mom?
She had called out to her mother and father.
Daddy,
hearing no response, her mind began to race as she stepped through the shattered glass and overturned furniture littering the room.
Dad! Mom! Dad!
As she called 911, Michelle could hear a weak voice calling out from another room. Next to the basement door, she noticed a bloody palm print.
Dad? Dad, are you here?
She walked down into the dimly lit room, not knowing what or who she might find.
Mom?
Lying next to each other, motionless on the floor, she discovered her parents. Her father, Jack, was barely alive. As she reached to take her mother's pulse, she lifted the sheet. Her mother, Anna, was dead. Michelle waited by her father's side for help to arrive. Her parents had been bludgeoned and bound. Michelle's description of the couple that had stopped by her parents' house earlier that day matched the fugitives, Coleman and Brown. A forensic team went to work collecting evidence. Among the items was a pair of plastic shoes next to Anna Stone. A recent sighting of the suspects included a description of Brown wearing these same shoes. Crime scene technicians also retrieved other bloodied tools found around the body. Later, forensics confirmed the crowbar was used to kill Mrs. Stone. Coleman's prints were all over it. He made no attempt to conceal his crimes. But there was nothing to suggest where the couple had gone.
It was all dead ends. Every time we'd find a body, they were gone. You don't have anything as to which way they're going. You have no indicators as to who their next victim's going to be. Depends. If they wanted sexual gratification, they may snatch a child. If they need a vehicle, they may snatch an adult. Just don't know. We've got a couple of mad dogs out there.
The crime against the Stones showed the couple was able to gain the trust of people from outside the black urban centers where they had found their first four victims. This realization only complicated the investigation. Coleman could fit in anywhere.
Where they would come up on a bicycle and start chatting, and he would be looking to play in a card game, or sometimes they would respond, they wanted to buy something, or they had something for sale. He was an extremely glib person, a real con man, and people trusted him. Plus, he was traveling with a woman, and so people were not nearly as suspect of him as they should have been.
Though Coleman's rage continued to intensify, his ability to charm more victims remained consistent. And he was showing no signs of growing tired of the kill. A month and a half had passed since Alton Coleman and Deborah Brown embarked on a killing spree that had left five victims dead. In Cincinnati, Coleman bludgeoned a husband and wife, leaving the wife dead and the husband barely clinging to life. Their car was missing. An APB was immediately put out on the vehicle. Two days later, a farm worker discovered the abandoned car on his property in Lexington, Kentucky, 105 miles away from the crime in Cincinnati. In less than 2 days, the fugitives had traveled hundreds of miles across two states. The FBI media blitz was leaving them with few places to hide. But the couple appeared to be heading further away from their home in Illinois, not closer, as investigators had hoped.
When you're talking about Alton Coleman and Deborah Brown, they are not a normal killing machine. A normal killing machine is going to be one person. We've now got two out there. They're working together. They're feeding off each other, and one's giving support. Those are the problems. How do you? We couldn't separate them. We couldn't talk to one. We couldn't talk to either one of them.
Knowing Coleman would eventually need to steal a car, the FBI saturated the Lexington, Kentucky area. They did not have to wait long for signs that he was still in town. In a hotel parking lot, Professor Oline Carmichael was assaulted and his car stolen. A couple forced him to hand over his cash and car keys. Leaving the professor wounded but still alive, they sped away. After receiving medical attention, police asked Carmichael to look at mugshots that included the FBI's most wanted fugitives. Without hesitating, he pointed to Coleman and Brown.
That's her, without a doubt. Those are two.
The FBI were now only a few hours behind the fugitives. An APB was issued for Carmichael's car. In a matter of hours, they received a response. It came from police in an Ohio town close to the Kentucky border. The professor's car was found, abandoned behind some vacant buildings. Coleman and Brown, however, were nowhere in sight. For the experienced agents, finding the car in Ohio meant Coleman and Brown were probably on their way home.
Gut instinct is going to tell you that he's going to come back home. He may not come back to Waukegan, but he's going to come back to some place that he feels comfortable with. He'd never been to Gary, Indiana. He'd never been to Detroit. He had never been to Toledo. Had never been to Cincinnati, Dayton, Ohio, Lexington, Kentucky. At some point, he's going to get tired, and he's going to want to get back to comfort. Some place that he feels comfortable. He knows the streets. He knows the people. He's going to feel comfortable. He's coming back.
The FBI immediately set up a dragnet. Agents and police officers from across several states joined forces to track Coleman and Brown as they headed home to Illinois. Reports of stolen vehicles or assaults were to be given immediate attention. An officer in Dayton, Ohio, responded to a report involving an assault and a stolen car. The call came from an elderly couple, Reverend and Mrs. Gay. Reverend Gay had been badly beaten. Mrs. Gay told the officer that a young couple who they had met weeks earlier broke into their house. After beating them, the attackers demanded the keys to their station wagon. According to the description, the attackers were Coleman and Brown. New leads were coming in at a furious pace. Coleman and Brown were still just out of reach. But the FBI was starting to close the gap. The day after the attack in Ohio, detectives involved in the FBI's dragnet discovered a station wagon that had been abandoned near a car wash in Indiana. It belonged to Reverend Gay. Later in the day, some road crew workers on the edge of Interstate 65 outside of Zionsville, Indiana, made a gruesome discovery. It was the body of an elderly man who had been reported missing from his home in Indiana. He was found on his 77th birthday. Evidence left at the scene was unmistakable. Coleman and Brown had claimed another life. The body was found less than 20 miles from the couple's home turf. The country's most wanted fugitives had come home, and the FBI was waiting for them. For 7 weeks, Coleman and Brown assaulted and killed victims in six different states. While investigators worked the crime scenes, scores of local officers and agents organized a dragnet to trap them as they headed back home to Illinois. The aggressive media campaign was having an impact. On July 20th, in Evanston, Illinois, a man spotted Alton Coleman with Deborah Brown in Mason Park. While he waited with the car running, his friend called the police.
Yes.
It was the one phone call investigators had been hoping for.
Yes.
He went to school with Alton Coleman. He knew without a shadow of a doubt that the man that crossed the street in front of him was Alton Coleman.
Evanston police responded. Only a couple of yards stood between the law and Coleman and Brown. With surprising ease, they were able to corner Coleman. He insisted they had the wrong man. A second pair of officers surrounded Brown. When asked, she gave a different pair of names for herself and Coleman.
What's your name?
Trina Williams.
Having found a knife and a false identification, the officers brought Alton Coleman to the police station.
Four other units be advised. When you pick up the female, she might have a weapon in her purse. Make sure you check it. She's been here.
A search of Brown's handbag uncovered a .38 caliber pistol.
523-607. Meet us over here. We got
the weapon was all they needed to handcuff her and take her in.
Anything we need to know that?
Two of the FBI's most wanted were apprehended without incident. After nearly 2 months, the violent rampage was over. Coleman continued to insist he hadn't been in any of the places where the murders happened. But the forensic evidence collected over the past 7 weeks proved otherwise. Alton Coleman was charged with the federal crime of kidnapping Vernita Wheat, followed by murder charges in three other states. Deborah Brown was also charged for her role in the murders. As investigators from the task force looked on, a strip search uncovered a bloody steak knife. It would be linked to yet another murder, a 15-year-old Ohio girl, Alice Myers. Illinois State's attorney Matthew Chancy was given the task of prosecuting Alton Coleman. In his mind, the motive was simple.
With Vernita Wheat, he crossed a threshold, and once he crossed that threshold, it was easy for him. And I think that he enjoyed it. And it wasn't just easy anymore. It was something he liked. He liked doing, and so he looked for every opportunity he could to repeat that.
Together, Coleman and Brown had stolen 7 lives. 3 states sought to take theirs. Brown stood trial separately. She was sentenced to life in prison. Until the end, she was committed to Coleman.
At Coleman's sentencing hearing for that murder, she testified on his behalf that she had committed the murder and he had not, in an obvious attempt to try to save him. It didn't work.
Coleman and Brown's rampage had covered over 1,300 miles in 6 states. For Special Agent Berdina Pessinelli, the intensity of the FBI's hunt prevented more needless murders.
Because of the massive investigation that we did and the publicity that we did, that he was caught within 7 weeks of when he started. Had we not done that, had we not gotten on this right away, who knows how long he would have gone on killing people.
In the end, Alton Coleman was sentenced to death 4 times. He went to prison in Ohio, where he was executed on April 26, 2002.